studios in Urbana. It's 79 degrees. It's 12:40. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Google has fired the first shot in what might come to be known as the Map Wars. Yesterday, the company unveiled new features such as maps in 3D. Google made its move just 5 days before Apple is expected to announce its own new and improved mapping software. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Google's 3D map feature is pretty cool. The company showed off a 3D San Francisco, and you could zoom in and look at the architectural details of the city like it was a video game. To create these lifelike 3D images, Google engineer Peter Birch says the company has a fleet of planes flying over cities and the countryside taking pictures.
Then the planes are flown in a very tightly controlled pattern to make sure that there's a sufficient amount of overlap so that we can get a complete picture and be able to represent large metropolitan areas.
If you're about to go on a vacation to London, you can get a 3D look at the city. If you download the map first, you can plot your evening out while you're on the underground and offline. But the buzz is that Google made the announcements this week because Apple is likely to introduce its own version of Maps on Monday during its Worldwide Developers Conference. That is likely to mean that Google will no longer be the default map system on iPhones and iPads. This is bad news for Google, given the importance of location systems to the local ad market. However, Google says it will continue to make its maps accessible to all operating systems. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
The amount of digital information being stored today is ballooning, and this boom is what is known as big data. It's expected to produce thousands of new jobs over the next several years, especially in the high-tech hub around Boston. Kurt Nickisch of member station WBUR reports.
Go to a server farm today and you will freeze. The air conditioning is running full blast nonstop to keep the computers from overheating. Rows and rows of them, lights blinking away. There are hundreds in the same amount of space as a single mainframe from decades ago.
Computers are now millions of times faster, storage is millions of times larger.
But Sam Madden, a professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, says today's computers still basically store and handle data the same way they did back in the 1970s. And he says that just doesn't cut it anymore.
It's time to kind of rethink these designs to say how we would build things differently now for this new kind of data.
Big data. That's the catchphrase for the trillions of gigabytes that are being recorded and stored nowadays. All our online transactions, the booming number of digital sensors out there, satellite images, the smartphones we carry, more complex data and more of it.
The amount of data involved is so overwhelming.
That's Justin Ratner. He's the chief technology officer of Intel Corporation. You probably have an Intel chip in your personal computer. Ratner thinks big data presents opportunities that could be as big as the personal computing revolution or the internet.
Very transformational. It definitely warrants Intel's attention.
It may be that his California-based company has to design new processors to handle these giant, complex, ever-growing databases. It may mean redesigning computers so they can feed more data to the processors right when somebody wants to find out something.
This is not, you know, like running the accounts receivable program overnight so when everybody comes in the office the next morning, they know who's paid and who hasn't paid. I mean, this is right now, real time. We're going to need extremely fast access to that information.
To figure out what kind of new technologies will be needed to make sense of big data, Intel is opening a research and development center at MIT. One reason the California company chose the Boston Area University is because this city is already home to around 100 companies working on big data problems.
What do? We build software tools for data scientists.
Marilyn Matz is the CEO of one of them, a company called Paradigm 4. One of her clients is an insurance firm that would like to offer auto coverage on the fly, meaning you only buy insurance when you take your car out of the garage.
In your car right now, when you plunk in an address and it comes back and says there are three routes, now imagine that for each route, it will tell you the insurance that you would pay for that route at that time of day.
Matz's company software would help the insurance company perform that complex calculation from multiple giant data sets in real time. Her company's in Boston because a lot of the companies she works with are here too. Pharmaceutical firms researching reams of genetic data. Financial services firms also, she says.
You always produce better tools when you're working closely with the people that know how to ask the right questions, and you can facilitate their work.
That kind of collaboration is expected to create 15,000 big data jobs here over the next 6 years. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.
Impressionist Claude Monet's garden in France draws 500,000 visitors a year. And now Americans will get a chance to enjoy the serenity of that scene. The New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx is bringing together an exhibit that recreates the garden Monet loved, along with photographs, videos, rare documents, and two of Monet's paintings. Here's NPR's Margot Adler.
Whether or not you have ever experienced Claude Monet's garden in France in Giverny, if you walk into the recreation at the New York Botanical Garden, prepare to be stunned. Scaled down to be sure, but in some ways even more riotous in its abundance of flowers and colors, you step through the portal, through a facade of Monet's house with its salmon-colored walls and green shutters, out into a long corridor of flowers.
When I walked in here, I thought, wow.
9-year-old Vanessa Calvo and adults Mary Quinton and Karen Rhodes.
I was speechless.
Like going into a paradise. Really beautiful.
Oh, just got goosebumps.
All these flowers, more than 150 species, which will change as the exhibit runs through 3 seasons, have been grown from seed by the gardening team at the New York Botanical Garden. Todd Forrest, head of horticulture, says the goal is to capture the essence of Monet's garden.
The incredible, overpowering color and the spirit of natural beauty that it infused and informed his paintings. We hope that visitors to the whole exhibition will leave understanding that Monet would never have been the painter he became if he wasn't the gardener he was.
Monet rented the house in Giverny in 1883 and lived there until his death in 1926. He, his children, and stepchildren worked in the garden. And eventually, as he became wealthy and bought the house and more land, he hired 5 gardeners. The exhibition includes 2 paintings of flowers, one early and one never before shown in the States, darker in color and tone, painted during the First World War. There's also his artist's palette of colors, the only one in existence. But clearly his garden was another palette. Forrest says Monet was constantly tweaking his garden, experimenting with plants. There was even a part of the garden he called paint box beds,
where he experimented with color combinations and texture and height combinations, kind of off the beaten path, before he was happy enough with those combinations to include them in his garden.
Oh, my heavens.
Lupins.
Ah, but these are lupins not like you see anywhere.
We've been growing these plants, in some cases, for a year or more, and we've been preparing for the exhibition for the past 2 years.
Brilliant blue delphiniums, pink and white foxglove, roses and poppies, mixed with wildflowers, one of Monet's innovations, like mullein you might find by the roadside. Forrest thinks Monet would be pleased with this recreation, but also a little envious, since here every spring flower seems to be blooming at once. Paul Hayes Tucker is a Monet expert and curator of this exhibition.
Monet would be green with envy, pink with envy, white with envy over what Todd and his team have been able to do, both in terms of the abundance of the flowers and their size and their color.
Tucker chose the 2 paintings that you can see in a separate gallery. The gardens, he says.
They defined him. They gave him life. They added spiritual zest to his being. And they obviously were absolutely central to his conceptions about art.
There wouldn't be a Monet's garden without the water lilies. Todd Forrest shows me the outdoor pool where they're just beginning to bloom. Some are the same types from the same nursery in France where Monet went. Monet first saw colorful hybrid water lilies at the 1899 Paris World's Fair.
There must be at least 15 or 20 different types of water lilies.
More like 50 on display in this pool alone.
Monet painted the water lilies over and over. Paul Hayes Tucker says the gardens are a living work of art, like a still life. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
Listeners like you appreciate and enjoy programming that consistently offers balanced perspectives, enlightening information, and educational entertainment. Have you thought of including WILL in your estate plans? Our Legacy Circle members provide for the station for years to come by investing in the future of WILL. Contact your financial advisor or call Donda Beard at 217-333-7300 or online at will.illinois.edu/support.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 7th of June, 2012. It's the birthday of the linguist, best-selling author Deborah Tannen, born Brooklyn, 1945. Studied linguistics, wrote a book, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, which was on the bestseller list for almost 4 years. It's the 60th birthday of the Turkish novelist Orhan Pamuk, born in Istanbul, 1952, studied architecture, journalism, at 23 decided to become a novelist, lived with his mother, wrote full-time, and 7 years later published his first novel. He's worked as a novelist for 30 years, and aside from 3 years he spent in New York, he's lived his entire life in the Istanbul district of his birth. In 2005, Orhan Pamuk gave an interview in which he talked about the Armenian genocide and the mass killing of tens of thousands of Kurds. He said, 30,000 Kurds have been killed here and 1 million Armenians, and almost nobody dares to mention that, so I do. Whereupon criminal charges were filed against Pamuk in Turkey, and Parliament passed a law making it illegal to make anti-Turkish remarks. There was a great outcry. Many authors, including Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Umberto Eco, John Updike, Gunter Grass, spoke in Pamuk's defense, and the charges were dropped early in 2006. His most recent books include The Naive and Sentimental Novelist and Pieces from the View, Life, Streets, Literature. And it's the birthday of Louise Erdrich, born in Little Falls, Minnesota, 1954. Grew up in Wahpeton, North Dakota, oldest of 7 children. Father came from a family of German immigrants. Her mother, French Ojibwe. Both her parents taught in an Indian school. Louise Erdrich said, "My father used to give me a nickel for every story I wrote, and my mother wove strips of construction paper together and stapled them into book covers, so at an early age I felt myself to be a published author, earning substantial royalties." She went on to Dartmouth in the first class that admitted women, wrote poetry, supported herself as a farm laborer, lifeguard, a flag girl on a road construction crew. She came out with a book of poetry, Jack Light, then started writing fiction. And her first novel, Love Medicine, 1984, was a bestseller and won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her book, The Roundhouse, is due out later this year.